Mask off.
Need a mask off moment here.
Mask off moment. It's Drew.
Welcome. It was Drew all along.
It was old man Drew. I'm just kidding. Welcome back to Metropolis. It is November 30th, 2023. It's a nice 3 degrees today. It's not too cold. It's not too cold. Today on Metropolis, we are talking about hashtag build the loop, the new Montreal 2024 budget, the Front Commun strikes, the new Quebec Solidaire co-spokesperson that's been elected, and the war on Christmas. I'm joined today by Drew Oyajay, publisher at The Breach and executive director of CUTV. I realized it was already on the other side. So, how are you doing today, Drew?
Things are good. Yeah, delighted to be here.
Yeah, terrific. Yeah, I'm happy you're delighted. Shall we get into this?
Let's get into it.
All right. Building the loop. So, the loop, if some of you might have seen, it is a fantasy map, a sort of fantasy transit map, if you could get it on this screen. Essentially, a sort of a loop system of cities, Canadian, both Canadian and American, and it's essentially we're looking at a proposed sort of a transit map. It's called, the creator, Adam Suzanek, made this in 2019. He calls it the Greater Northeast Corridor. So, for example, we have on this Greater Northeast Corridor, we have Montreal to Boston in 56 minutes, Boston to New York in 35 minutes, New York City to Philadelphia in 16 minutes, Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. in 21, Washington, D.C. to Detroit in 72, Detroit to Toronto in 34 minutes, Toronto to Montreal in 51 minutes. And so this would essentially be powered by a high-speed maglev train similar to the ones like the Shinkansen in Japan or the high-speed rail system in China. Drew, did you see this going viral?
I did see it going viral, yeah. It was all over Instagram and Twitter. It's interesting. It's I think it's really important to have these sort of, especially in moments when these kind of things feel totally impossible, you actually have, the most sort of prominent transportation's, so-called experts like Elon Musk actually actively working to undermine any kind of like high-speed rail, and was successful in undermining it by like hyping this totally non-existing thing called the Hyperloop. Was actually able to use that to like stop a like not super high speed but certainly higher speed rail project in California.
It was Anaheim to San Francisco or something like that. It's a very busy corridor.
So that's the kind of situation that we're in, right? Like we're even the sort of obvious rail projects that get proposed in North America sort of don't come to pass or are forever studied. Canada in the Windsor to Quebec City corridor has been like studying and making proposals for like decades. I mean, Michael Ignatieff was like flirting with the idea of like upgrading the rail system. Mm-hmm. He never became prime minister, but that's how long ago it was that we've been talking about this. Obviously, it goes back a decade before that even. So in that context of sort of futility, I think it's interesting and inspiring to think about like what could be. I guess the one thing that I would sort of take issue with is like the statement that's littered right here is this would literally destroy the North American airline industry, and I don't think it would. And I think that is precisely that kind of goes to the core, I think, of what I think is the not the problem, but the sort of missing piece with things like this. I think it's really important for us to think about, okay, what does our sort of climate-friendly future look like? Mm-hmm. What does the future of like not having everybody stuck in cars on highways, and burning through our sort of ecological capacity at a just at totally unsustainable rate, look like? But if you're going to build the loop, I think you do have to, destroy something else. I think it would start with, private jets. Like you'd have to just phase those out completely.
I don't want to get rid of mine though.
No. Okay. Well, you can keep yours, but, in general, we should phase them out. you know, we have to start taking steps to actually reduce emissions, mm-hmm. not just create less emitting things, but actually reduce the existing emissions. And that's really the challenge. I mean, I think with both, you know, Trudeau and, Trudeau and Biden, at the same time, you see there's plenty of investment in, you know, battery plants or like, you know, green infrastructure. Mm-hmm. But you don't see the concomitant, you know, commitment to reducing emissions in terms of like the amount of oil extraction that's happening, in terms of the amount of cars on the road. I mean, very, very slowly, and they tend to be very shy about that. So I think this is half of the sort of start of like our regional transportation vision that we need to think about.
And you think the other half would be just reducing, like, let's say, the reliance on like cars and as well as like private jets.
Yeah. I think you have to have a plan to do both. And the reason I say private jets is because I think we have to start with the Uber consumer class, like the billionaire class, that is just like their carbon emissions per capita are just off the charts. Mm-hmm. So I think you start by making an example of them. because otherwise it doesn't have any credibility. If you start charging people carbon taxes, you know, we've seen the kind of backlash that happens from that. So clearly we need to build a lot of stuff. We need to like massively increase the transit capacity in general, like locally probably is the most important, but certainly interregionally. But we also have to find a ways to reduce things. And I think the way you do that with credibility is you start with the ultra rich,
the worst offenders.
Exactly. Like you have to basically, I think, have the goal of eliminating short haul flights, and then eventually long haul. Cool. But domestic flights in Canada should be, you know, if we had taken the climate crisis seriously, we would be phasing those out. Mm-hmm. You know, we would be at the tail end of phasing those out right now. We have a lot of catching up to do.
No, you don't think people are taking it seriously because those are still in place and they haven't really been decreased in their usage?
No. But it's also, I mean, I also have to say, like, this is fundamentally appealing, you know, certainly to someone like me who has, like, friends in a bunch of these cities. I'd love to be able to go, mm-hmm. you know, not spend, you know, whatever it is, 12, 15 hours on the train to get to New York. Mm-hmm. But, you know, actually have it be accessible it should be. I mean, it's 7 hours by car. We're the richest civilization in human history. We should have something like this.
Yeah. But we don't. There's something about that I think is interesting, right? We have this idea of, I feel like when people look at this, they're tapping into their, like, the current kind of, like, scale of, like, time that they have to do these kinds of travels, right? I went to, like, D.C. earlier this month. I went to Boston as well. And it's, like, both of those were kind of, like, pretty, like, long drives. D.C. was, like, I think around, like, 12, 13 hours, right? And mm-hmm. then this is kind of presenting an option where I can be there in, like, maybe, like, what was that? What would that be? Let me just do some quick math here. 2 hours to be in DC, right? And I think,
yeah, sounds good.
And in my mind, that like decreases the kind of like just like time spent in between. But I do think there is this, because we're working from our current perspective and like everything is shrunk, I think there's things that people miss out on with this kind of thing. I think there's there's something where like there's this theory in I believe it's in like urban planning, or it's something like the amount of time people will travel, the maximum amount of time people will travel to like a workplace is something like an hour, right?
Yeah.
And so this makes it so there are entirely new kind of like populations that are now open to like labor markets in other cities, right?
Yeah.
And I find there's something about that that would create an incredibly kind of different like dynamic. One that's like, I talk about this, but it's like incredibly hard to predict. And I mean, like one easy thing to think about, because, I think before when people were talking about like the pink line in Montreal, Valerie Plante's old proposition, Projet Montréal, rather old proposition to add a new metro line that goes through the more denser and poorer areas of the city. One concern that was brought up by Jason Prince was that without certain kind of protections of these neighborhoods, the metro stations, and in this case, maybe like the new hubs for high speed rail, sort of become like these center points for gentrification, right? So it's like, if we had a version of this that didn't have whatever sort of like regulation, then suddenly you have like a the class of people in each of these cities who have this kind of wealth to like move around, change yeah. around like that, they were going to be the ones who are kind of displacing people around these cities. And there's kind of like almost like a, I don't know if it's a super kind of like charged kind of gentrification, but like now we have to, you're not only competing with like now it's like working class people aren't only competing with rich capital, like people of like capital in their cities, but now there's also this competition from other cities because of this kind of like,
absolutely.
Because of the kind of efficiency to that. And I'm kind of curious what other kind of like, I don't know, is there anything about this that you think people are a little too gung-ho about, something that angles to that people are kind of not really considering?
I think it really appeals to certainly people in my demographic, like, you know, sort of educated, professional, mobile.
Good looking. You know, smart.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so way to throw me off my thought here. It appeals to people in this sort of like, you know, I don't know, yeah, professional sort of demographic. Mm-hmm. Sort of the nomadic worker, the laptop toting class, you
yes,
know.
Yes.
And that's a minority of the population. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's fine for this to appeal to, you know, myself. It certainly appeals to me. But I think we also have to, you know, think about the sort of implications. And I think what you're pointing to is interesting. You have like a, you know, neoliberal, there's sort of a frictionless neoliberal quality to kind of what this could be in the sense that you have, yeah, you have like the ability to move from city to city in this like, it, you know, in one way you could say it's sort of a democratization of this sort of, you know, intercity travel. But on the other hand, yeah, it is also like a, it is a way to make labor more flexible and mobile, and to pit larger populations of people against each other in terms of their, in terms of wages, in terms of lots of different things. So I think that's not to say you shouldn't do it, but it's like, okay, you need a bigger vision than just that. It's like, okay, like, you know, one aspect of that is, okay, how are you going to reduce emissions on the other end? Mm-hmm. Another aspect of that is like you said, how are you going to, you know, up the standard of living for everybody and not create these sites of further
stratification.
Sort of, yeah, stratification, but also just like investment and exploitation. I mean, international capital is very interested in buying up housing next to these sort of hubs, right. Especially, you know, maybe not right next to it, but certainly, you know, a short cab ride from one of these hubs. I think it just ups the real estate value. And if you're in a speculation-based, profit-making-based housing market, then it just makes everything that we're already seeing worse. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, people buying up condos, people buying up second homes, using them as investment properties, rents going through the roof, people not being able to find places to live, and so mm-hmm. on. So I think we have to take those things into account and make it part of a holistic vision. I think that's the challenge.
Holistic is always a key word, yeah. And something this makes me think of as well is like with the construction of kind of bigger like federal highways and autobahns, yeah. Right? You had these kinds of like towns that used to be sort of like the pit stops in between like whatever trajectories between like large cities. And because of these new kind of like very long highways that didn't really stop by these towns, you had these towns that sort of like petered off, right? Yeah. And it kind of, I mean, it's pure speculation. Yeah. I mean, as this map, but I'm kind of curious as to that effect on, let's say, like cities between Montreal and Toronto, cities between Montreal and Boston, right? That used to, at least on some level, thrive. I don't know about thrive, but at least survive off of this kind of interurban travel.
I mean, there's another sort of interesting angle. I mean, you see people in Silicon Valley who have this sort of higher incomes, like commuting by plane, basically, mm-hmm. You know, into these sort of like little regional airports, like, you know, and then going off to their whatever their hideaway is, you know, mm-hmm. Where they can have lots of land and, you know, privacy and whatever else. And so, yeah, you could see this. I mean, this could change things in, you know, in good and bad ways. I mean, you could see, you know, places like Kingston become like a bedroom community, you know, right. Like potentially if you get to the point where it's cheap enough and accessible enough. Again, that becomes like an urban planning challenge for sure. Not to say that it's all bad, but does everybody in between Montreal and Toronto want to be like a bedroom community or like, it's going to change the economics. And I mean, it, you know, COVID, I think, already did in terms of like people's will, people's ability to work remotely. Mm-hmm. You know, those dynamics combined with access, the access to like cheap high speed rail, you know, would transform things, and not necessarily for the worse, but
transform things.
when you have a whole bunch of, you know, professionals moving into these like little rural communities that don't have the capacity to like handle that kind of infrastructure, you're going to have conflict, you're going to have problems. Mm-hmm. And if there's not like resources available to those municipalities to like deal with them, then you're going to it's going to create more friction politically and more backlash.
Fascinating. Yeah. No, just for the record, I do look forward to something like this.
Yeah.
But I find for myself there's always an attempt to try and like think about it in the most kind of sober fashion. You know, this is a... No, I mean, clearly this is a...
I mean, on the basic level, it's just an obvious thing to do.
Of course.
It's a completely obvious thing to do that we should have been doing. But I mean, and you can look at all the like ridiculous barriers that are in place mm-hmm. to doing it, which are, you know, irrational and counter to us having a, you know, livable society.
What would you say some of the barriers are? Because I know
yeah.
there's like this study done for HSR, high speed rail in England, and they found that like per kilometer is like, so like magnitude is much more expensive than a place like China, right?
Right.
In the Pearl River Delta, this like massive, like kind of like mega city. It's like, I think their plan was to try and connect something like 7 different cities there. It's this total area is like, I think 300 square kilometers is being covered, and they want to make it so anyone can get to work in under an hour with yeah. kind of high speed train, right? And it's something like, I think this is, it's not like the same kind of intention behind it, but there is a similar kind of like end result, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just neoliberalism. It's just like a total failure of the imagination. It has created, like each politician is this sort of like fundraising brand that mm-hmm. is trying to like get the most money from the existing corporate interests. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the ideology that sort of like, you know, is the sort of capstone on that material reality of being a politician in the US, certainly in Canada, I think it's more ideological, honestly. But the ideology is like government can't do big things. Mm-hmm. The government can't provide services. You have to outsource everything. You have to privatize everything. And so when you want to do big things, you end up something like the REM, you know, mm-hmm. where you put a ton of public money into something that is ultimately, you know, a privately owned enterprise.
Right. So for our listeners, the REM is the Réseau Express Métropolitain. It's kind of like this above ground. Say again?
The one, the only.
The one, the only. Yeah, not the band. what is it? It was funded mostly by, I believe, the Quebec Pension Fund. And there's a lot of kind of sketchy stuff with real estate developers yeah. who own properties near the proposed stops.
Not the band, but it, if you learn the details of the REM, it will make you lose your religion.
that's good. That's a good one. Right. What are we talking about right now? The losing my religion thing made me lose my train of thought. Right? Another one. private capital. Anyways.
Next topic.
The budget. The Montreal municipal budget for 2024. Close to $7 billion. I think Valérie Plante in a press scrum was saying it's a light 3.5% increase. Can we get the article up? All right, so here we are, article in CBC. The headline, taxes are about to jump. What's in Montreal's $7 billion budget, and how will it affect you? Tax increase for homeowners kept under inflation rate, but the hike will still be felt. This is by Anthony Nerestant, Sabrina Jonas, at CBC News Montreal. I think there's the budget. The budget is huge, right? We're a big city, so it's like these budgets are like... I think these numbers are... huge, right? We have $7 billion. I think if you look into it, it's like that there's around $715 million alone on public transportation, $34 million of which is for paying for Opus cars for seniors with the new decision for people above 65 to go fare-free. I think on other big numbers in it, we have 582 million over the next 10 years. Yes, so whenever they release these, they always make little adjustments to their like long-term forecast, so we see like a broader vision of what the city is planning. So yeah. 582 million over the next 10 years for affordable, social, and community housing. Most of that is apparently going to be used for buying land and property for those for that kind of housing.
I was going to say 50 million a year. That's like 50 condos.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, year, right, basically.
Yeah. Right. Which is kind of interesting. I think we should kind of get into that.
I don't know if that's
that.
Going to really like meet the demand.
No, yeah, yeah. Because I guess, yeah, so let's go into that, right? Because yeah. I find there is this thing that the city kind of has to like, it's this game that the city's playing. I feel like we talked about this before, right? Yeah. Where they're trying, with the kind of pedestrianization, the beautification strategies, they're sort of trying to increase property values because that's something the city has like to rely on. Because there's not too much money coming from like Quebec or the federal government, and so the city has to rely on things like property taxes, almost solely property taxes, fares to a certain extent, but even then it's like negligible. So I find, in my view, when I kind of see this stuff and when I hear people kind of complaining about the, maybe not complaining, but like when I see articles that kind of try to center this thing about tax hikes, and I think there's a Global News piece that was talking about, I think the average kind of tax hike would amount to something like $225 a year for any kind of property owners. When I hear this, to me, this is Projet Montréal after so many years of pedestrianization, beautification of streets, kind of this kind of like trying to beautify the city, essentially, right? Making it more like walkable, which is good and all and fine. But now I feel like they're like, okay, we did the thing. We kind of raised property values for you guys a little bit. Time to like pay up. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that. I think, I mean, if you look at where the cost increases are coming, like they're talking about snow removal, like doubling in cost. And I don't know, that certainly isn't only attributable to fuel costs. There's something else happening there. Maybe there's a labor shortage. Maybe the people doing it are squeezing the market. I'm not sure. But in any case, there are objectively larger costs, and it is a growing city. They are adding a number of new, you know, positions and like bureau offices. They are also adding a large number of police officers, which I think we'll probably talk about in a future episode.
Oh, yes.
But there's a big, there's a big emphasis on adding police officers. I mean, I think the basic thing is like, yeah, if you raise taxes in an undifferentiated way in these various neighborhoods, like you're going to, it's regressive, right? Like you're going to, like landlords are just going to immediately pass that on to their tenants and rent, and probably add a little padding on for themselves. Mm-hmm. You're going to have, homeowners who are, not always doing great, especially if they've really scraped together like one of these giant down payments for these inflated housing prices recently. I mean, obviously, if you're bought a house in the 70s or 80s, you're
fine. You're maybe not fine, but
you're chilling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, if you bought a house in the last like 10 years, I mean, oh my God, an extra little, if you're not, wealthy, like you're an extra little couple percentage points on your taxes. And also, I don't understand if land prices are going up, why do taxes have to go up? Mm-hmm. I mean, this framing of keeping tax increases under the inflation rate doesn't make sense, because your property values are getting inflated. And so why would you need to increase the percentage of that property value that you're taxing? I mean, so
you think keep it at the same amount, but because property values go up, you're just going to get...
Yeah, if my property was worth $100,000 2 years ago, and then there's, a 10% inflation, and property values across the board go up 10%, then you don't, like, a 2% tax is going to go up by 10% in terms of the actual amount that I'm paying, right? So you don't need to actually increase the tax rate, is all I'm saying. That said, I mean, I think basically what we're seeing is that Projet Montréal is running a competent neoliberal city. I mean, that's I think, they're putting a lot of money into a lot of things. They're properly staffing certain things. They're building bike lanes. They're creating year-round bixie service. They're plowing the bike lanes in the winter.
So that usually they're the first to be plowed.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, they're fixing the roads. I mean, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. They're doing things like, you know, Montreal roads were basically built by the mafia, and who was, you know, like massively skimping on the amount of concrete being put down and pocketing the difference, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we have all these potholes, because of all the sort of corruption that happened in the, you know, previous generations, basically. So yeah, they are, unlike other administrations, trying to fix that. So again, a competent neoliberal administration, and what I'm saying, what makes them neoliberal, you know, and they're also increasing the amount of buses and so on. And certainly not at the rate that we need to, but they are increasing it every year, which is, you know, good. But anyway, so I guess the way I would look at it is, like, if you're going to tax everybody equally, that's a regressive tax, especially if you haven't done the obvious things, like they could index parking fines to income. Mm-hmm. They could bring in a mansion tax. They could tax the increase of property values, that would actually, you know, keep housing prices relatively, at least stabilize them.
All right, puts a little ceiling on them a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to using them as a speculative asset, like, mm-hmm. if you, you know, are a, you know, I don't know, a real estate investment trust or a Saudi prince, and you want to buy some condos in downtown, mm-hmm. Montreal. Yeah, just imagine.
Yeah, I'm a Saudi prince. Ooh, St. Catherine, you say.
I'm more interested in what it would be, what your experience would be like as a real estate investment trust. I think visualizing that would be a more challenging thing. But yeah, if you're buying an extra condo and the price is going up by, like, you know, a larger percentage than the condo fees, then, you know, that's and you're basically making money and parking your money, and, you know, it's increasing in value. That's a thing that's happening quite a bit, whether it's people buying, you know, rich people buying second homes. That's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. Or whether it's, you know, foreign investors is, you know, in the mix for sure. But then there's also real estate investment trusts who have these sort of tax loopholes that they're taking advantage of. And they're basically just giant pools of capital that are buying up housing. Mm-hmm. And so all these things are making housing less and less accessible to people without adding anything of value to the market. Mm-hmm. So you could tax that. So there's all kinds of things that you could tax progressively, is my point. And I don't feel like they've really done any of those things, because right. what they would have to do is make the people with disproportionate amount of power disproportionately angry at them. And mm-hmm. that's not what a competent neoliberal government does. It puts the cost disproportionately on the people who are struggling, on the people who are sort of, you know, doing okay and getting by, mm-hmm. and lets the sort of ultra wealthy and the sort of upper professional classes, you know, benefit disproportionately. Mm-hmm. So those are my thoughts on the tax issue.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's, like you're saying, there's so much stuff to cover in this budget. I think it's, like, I guess this choice to raise the, oh, nice, we changed the slide. Nice.
Yeah.
So yeah, we can, yeah, I'm just going to say, the choice to actually, like, raise the taxes, would you count that as, so you're saying it's them being bad neoliberals, or it's them being
competent
right, because they're putting the burden on, like, whatever, like, kind of, like, just broad swath of people, rather than trying to be specific with progressive
taxes. It's like the old adage, like, the rich and the poor are equally equal before the law, in the sense that they're banned from
stealing bread
right, or sleeping in tents, right?
So just,
yeah,
heavy quotations on that. Yeah, so I mean, let's do a quick little look at this pie chart for the Montreal 2024 budget. So we have expenditures at $6.9937 billion. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's reaching $7 billion. The biggest chunk of it, 18.3%, on public security. So that's police. Mm-hmm. Like we're talking about, that was the, I think it's something like a,
yeah, they keep increasing the police budget. They
120 new.
They had an unprecedented increase in the last budget, and then the police went over that by like 48 million or something. So that mostly goes unreported. I mean, it's really interesting listening to the sort of media coverage, because they're just like, they're just cheering on this, like, massive increase in the police force, as if it's like the most important thing. And I think this comes down to like the basic tenor of like what we're talking about here. Right. Like, okay, you're running a competent neoliberal city, but it's also being emptied out by sort of the post-COVID reality of like telework and all these mm-hmm. things. Your sort of commercial core is on the decline. Your office space is like has like
vacancies,
just
huge vacancies,
alarming vacancy rates. Right. And you're dealing with all these issues. So how do you respond to that? Right? Mm-hmm. Do you respond with creativity and investment and economic development, or do you respond by like clamping down on the inevitable, crime rate going up mm-hmm. As people become more desperate, as they can't get mm-hmm. housing, even though, and as the sort of money that's coming into the downtown core is, starting to evaporate mm-hmm. Or certainly reduce. They made their decision. They decide, they put the priority on policing because mm-hmm. that's what's going to make who they see as probably the most important, the people who are going to vote the most, and the people whose support they're counting on for donations and everything. That's what's going to make them feel safe.
Right. Of course.
Is it going to make somebody who can't access housing or who is like spending 80% of their income on housing, is that going to make them feel safe? Probably not. Probably they have bigger fish to fry. But that's not, that's not what's going on.
Right, yeah. 18.3%, public security, second highest we have, debt servicing at 16.6%. After that, general administration, 11.1%. Culture, recreation and culture at 10.3%. In the past, this was not fourth on the list, so it used to be further back. I'm kind of curious about that. If you have any kind of just quick cursory kind of comments about the last kind of sections we just covered.
Excuse me. I'm not sure about the culture stuff. I would imagine that, again, like we were talking about, I think in one of the previous episodes I was on, like the model of culture, and we're not talking about like, we're talking about sort of tourism, basically, mm-hmm. Tourist-facing culture,
right,
as opposed to
your Oceagas, heavy MTLs, Igloo Fest, relying on kind of
these kinds of things,
right.
Festivals, the whole summer of festivals, like all this stuff. It's like stuff that's gonna bring money into the downtown core, and it's gonna be mostly extracted by the interests that have sort of found a way to find those sort of choke points of like people going to get food or whatever mm-hmm. and like extract the money from those
hotels.
Certainly. So I think that's the model that we're in. And my guess is the investment is mostly devoted to that, as opposed to other forms of culture, which can also have economic benefits, mm-hmm. But not in ways that immediately sort of benefit those, concentrated capital and their sort of power structures. It's not that you can't invest in culture, in a way that's going to create economic benefits that spread more broadly, whether it's investing in, rehearsal spaces or artistic spaces mm-hmm. or anything like that, or even artists themselves. Or affordable housing for artists, like all those things, create a more artistically vital
right. Instead,
the city
most likely this kind of top down for like these big players.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's like ? Like somehow these people are becoming artists, and then we extract the value from we skim off the top and them with like just enough to live, maybe mm-hmm. this like small class of professional artists, mm-hmm. as opposed to creating a city that is friendly to artistic creation and real creativity
at every level,
yeah. Which is obviously going to have a bigger long term result, but mm-hmm. is also harder to get political support from because artists have a want that they're not signing up new members to Project Montreal or giving multi-thousand-dollar donations.
They're gallivanting around.
They're making art. Yeah. They're whatever artists do.
Who knows. After that, we have 10.2% public transportation.
Yeah, so the public transportation is interesting. You were talking about how they're spending however many tens of millions. Was it 38 million?
It was. So that 10.2% is 715 million on public transportation. Mm-hmm. 34. It's a large increase from the previous budget. 34 million of that is
To buy Opus cards.
To buy Opus cards for seniors, because this was a campaign promise back in 2021 to make the use of public transportation free for people above 65. Yeah. So, your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, I think, like, as a policy, making transit free for seniors, I think, makes total sense. It's just that it should be a no-brainer, and certainly for youth as well, which I think they've done a little bit of. The issue with taking this approach of like phasing in free public transit for particular groups is that you still have to like maintain all the billing, all the sort of like, you know, you have to pay out, you're paying all these people like, you know, near six figure salaries to run around and harass people and ask them for their Opus card and scan it or whatever. So you have enforcement, and then you also, you know, which has no real social value except that, you know, it's ensuring that people are paying the cost, not the cost, but the ticket price. But then you also have all the machines. You know, you have all this IT. You have to make sure that it's working. You have to make sure all these machines are. You have to maintain all the machines. So it actually comes out to like a pretty significant percentage. I think it's, I don't remember the exact number, but it's certainly over 10% of the overall. So if you actually made transit free for everyone, you actually save a bunch of money, like a whole bunch of money, like right off the bat. But by phasing it in, you're basically having to like subsidize the cost of the like fee collection, even though it's free for those people.
Right, you're still maintaining that kind of accounting infrastructure, even though trying to make it free. While still trying to secure that,
so you're basically just paying their fare as opposed to creating a system that is based on progressive taxation, for example, that goes and says, okay, well, you know, there's the people who are making the most money in the city can pay a disproportionately large amount, and that can make it free for everybody, and everybody pays a bit, but people pay based on their ability to pay and out of proportion once they get into the higher income brackets. That would be the way, you know, then you save a bunch of money, you create a free service that's free for everybody. Create the inspiration for people to ride transit more. Of course, that has to be obvious. So this becomes sort of fantasy because, you know, it's something that we have to push for, not just the municipal level, because the municipal government can't implement that alone.
Of course.
Yeah. But if the feds came in and wanted to make it happen, you know.
Yeah, they have the financial
means to support that. It would not be a problem. They could do it instantly, but, and they should be. They should be putting a billion a year into Montreal, like upgrading a city like Montreal's transit infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Certainly, and if you're committed to climate, but also just like quality of life, also all kinds of things. We should just be making it available, making it possible to get on a not very crowded bus and go wherever you want to go at any time of day. Mm-hmm. That should be the goal. And so far it's not. It's mainly to get workers downtown, which is, you know, what the billions invested in the REM are based on, which is of course like not nearly as relevant as it used to be. Mm-hmm. But then also to get, you know, workers who can't afford to live downtown, you know, from wherever they're coming from the suburbs out into the downtown core, so they can provide all these services for all these people who are working there. So that's really the model that we're looking at for transit. Whereas like we could, if we were able to get the sort of political will and resources happening at the federal level, and there's no reason a big city couldn't throw its weight around that way. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
for a big city being the municipal players trying to advocate for that, or?
Well, I mean, just the electors, you know, if the entire Western Montreal stopped voting in lockstep for the Liberal Party,
it's a tall order.
Some interesting things could happen, right? But, you know, that's not what's happening at the moment. But or if they just put pressure on their elected representatives, those aren't the priorities that are being put forward by the people who have the time and energy and vision to approach their elected representatives and make demands. So it's not on the priority list. So, you know, not shockingly.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing this kind of. It's definitely an attempt by Projet Montréal, right, to start to like to appease some of the people who have been kind of like trying to go for this kind of like free public transportation, right? But instead of a full public transportation, they're going wave to the camera, this guy. But instead of going for that, they go for this kind of like piecemeal kind of like, okay, we can't do that, but we'll give you a bit.
Yeah.
And it's like it's almost like I guess in their mindset, it's like there's some kind of compromise, but it's actually like the end result is almost worse because of it's like still like you're saying, it still maintains that kind of accounting infrastructure. They still have to subsidize it. They're still paying for it.
They're also cutting it. I mean, honestly, this is coming at the expense of the overall network. Like they're talking about closing metros earlier
at 11 p.m.,
which is I mean, this is Montreal. Like, I mean, come on. I mean, maybe it's a different city. I remember it.
Let's look out the window.
But no, I mean, the idea that you would close the metro at 11 is just offensive in a city that of the, you know, with the sort of, I don't know, reputation. Like, we're talking about art. I mean, you know, if you're going to a show and you have to, like, check out, you have to like leave the bar at 11,
right,
you know, to get home. That's absurd.
Right. Or even earlier, right, if the metro's ending at
11. You'd have to leave at 10:30.
But then if the nightlife,
like, what kind of nightlife are you gonna have
if the nightlife still continues? Then it's like, how are people gonna get home? It's gonna be like they're still gonna need to get home. People still be out. It's gonna be relying on cars, right?
Yeah,
cars,
Uber,
or like Ubers,
buses, right. Waiting, you know, you'd be waiting in the cold, you know, for like half an hour for a bus, you know, to get home. I mean, these are not the sort of, this is not dignifying, you know, again what is, you know, one of the richest societies in the history of human civilization.
Right now we're at 40 minutes. We got to blaze through.
Oh, yeah, we really went hard on the
budget.
Let's keep going.
Speed round. So up next we are
go a bit over.
Up next we are talking about the Francomer strike.
Yeah.
So the Francomer is a, what I'm reading is the largest strike in the history of the Canadian state. This is by John Clark, former OCAP organizers in Toronto. The Francomer is essentially, this is a name that calls back to a strike in 1972 it was a big public sector strike that lasted, I believe, for 10 days. It involved 210,000 workers back then, teachers, healthcare workers. This time, they were calling that because right now it's, I think when the strike began on November 23rd or the week of November 23rd, it was 566,000 people. And they're saying, I think just yesterday, I believe they announced the intention to extend the strike for another 7 days for 420,000 workers. They're saying this is the, this 10-day strike so far is the longest public sector strike in the last 50 years. And also just to say who's taking part of this strike, the Francomer is the CSN, the CSQ, APTS, and the FTQ. So like all these like big players for like unions in Quebec, and we have them out on the street. I'm sure if people are in Montreal, you're walking around, you'll see them with the flags outside. Public like provincial buildings.
It is your civic obligation to honk.
It is such a joy for me to honk. For me, that's like when I'm thinking about like effort to like just how good I feel great. I feel like just driving by, I'm like just like really laying on the horn, you know. They get amped up.
Yeah,
sometimes just like two people, and I see they're just whatever on like a break from, and I'm still honking. You know?
Yeah.
They gotta know. But I'm not the only one honking either.
And as a pedestrian, you can clap and give them the fist.
This is true. Yeah. You can give them a little.
You know? Exactly.
Speaking about honking and the support, huge public support for this.
Yeah,
you know, and
shocking,
I think
shocking in a good way.
Yeah. Because sometimes, like, I think, this is like, sometimes unions are concerned about like a certain disrupting whatever kind of like public life or disrupting kind of services, right? Because of like this idea of whatever might be a inconvenience.
Sure.
citizen who is now not getting their services. But I think there's a Léger poll that came out that showed there's something like 71% of Quebecers polled were either were in support or in strong support of this strike, mm-hmm. right? And I think it really shows, to me anyways, just the kind of level of support and sympathy people have with these kinds of workers. Yeah, I'm kind of curious as to other thoughts you have about this historic strike we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's it shouldn't be necessary, but of course it is. Right. I mean, you have a, I mean, it really, I think, highlights the sort of deep contradictions of Quebec, you know, Quebec politics. You know, on the one hand, you have this just unprecedented level of support for effectively like deeply right-wing sort of paternalistic government, you know, in François Legault in the last election, which was not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So that's on the one hand, and I think that matches up with the sort of like, you know, debased political imagination, a sort of a middle class aspiration, where you have, you know, your people are, you know, people see the $500 check that he's dangling in front of him. They're like, cool, that sounds good to me. You know,
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have it framed on your wall.
No, I spent that real quick.
Yeah. So yeah, you have a situation where on the one hand, you have the sort of broader trend of neoliberalism, sort of, you know, doing its thing, you know, degrading our political imaginations, you know, making it very difficult to imagine anything better except for like personal advancement within the middle class framework, mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, buying a new CRV or whatever. But on the other hand, you have a culture, a political culture that's formed without, you know, for decades, for a century, more, without a political elite, without an economic elite. You have a situation where there was a linguistic divide, and there was an economic elite, but it was Anglophones, right?
Right.
And so you have a whole culture that has a deep reserves of social solidarity that are sort of latent, mm-hmm. because they're not being affirmed by any of the like, media or culture, you know, or sort of the culture that gets sort of fed to you on TV, which is very, you know, North American neoliberal. But it's still there somehow, you know, it still sort of exists, whether it's in the, I don't know, language, the way people relate to each other and mm-hmm. so on. And so, yeah, when you have a big strike, when 420,000 workers go on strike, all of a sudden something gets activated, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, 7 out of 10 people.
This kind of latent solidarity that was there, maybe quiet during elections, is kind of brought up again.
Yeah, and I would say it validates something that you basically never hear in the media, which is that the public sector is the you know, in a social democratic, or, you know, sort of post social democratic society, is the key mechanism for redistributing wealth, mm-hmm. along geographic lines, along racial lines, along gender lines. Having a well-paid public sector increases equality and erases inequalities and increases the sort of capacity for social solidarity on all those sort of levels.
Could you go into specifically how it does it along gendered lines?
Yeah, I mean, you have a big gender pay gap in the private sector, mm-hmm. first of all, mostly because of maternity leave, but also just because of sexism. But you also have disproportionate number of women who work in the public sector, you know, whether it's as teachers, nurses, or just functionaries. You have
pink collar jobs, I believe they call it.
Yeah. So you have a disproportionate number of women, and they're disproportionately forming, especially, you know, in the last couple decades, the leadership of these unions and the sort of organizing. And so, yeah, when you when you have these unions dedicated to, Public Service Alliance of Canada, for example, like had a huge multi-decade lawsuit on the sort of gender pay gap, which they won, and the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, for example, struck specifically for maternity leave, which set a precedent that rippled across all mm-hmm. kinds of different other sectors. That was in the 1980s, 1980, I think. But in any case, it's an engine for erasing these sort of inequalities and sort of structural oppressions that happen in society. And it's also an engine, which, and I think this is even less understood, for economic development, because you have, when you have the imperative to tax corporations more and to tax the rich more, mm-hmm. and then hand that money to working class people who provide a useful service that makes people's lives easier, making people's lives easier gives them more capacity to do things and be, you know, productive in both economic and sort of non-counted ways. But also it increases the amount of money in their pockets, so they go and spend it in their local communities, whether it's, you know, going to restaurants, buying clothes, you know.
There's more purchasing power.
Services, right. Like construction, all that stuff happens, and that creates more economic activity. And so it actually fuels economic growth, basically.
I think
I think this is undersold as one of the virtues of investing in the public sector. And so, you know, absolutely people's, you know, public sector workers' pay has fallen behind and should be brought up to the point of inflation. So the frequently cited piece, example is that you have police officers, you know, just renegotiated and they got a 20% pay rise over 5 years. Legault and his caucus, who recently voted themselves a 30% pay rise, not over any years, just when one shot, are now offering 9%.
You don't think they deserve it? They've been working so hard on destroying the province.
they are working very hard. So they're offering 9%,
right?
Which is not, it's not even a nice round 10. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
So I mean, the cause is just, absolutely, but I think that there's a bigger picture where not only they deserve 20%, but that's, you know, I think that the typical sort of neoliberal line is, oh, you're going to have to pay that in taxes now.
Right.
And I just don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, it's true if you run a neoliberal shop, but there's lots of money to go get, whether it's taxing, you know, excess profits, whether it's taxing corporate profits, whether, you know, there's all kinds of places to go get money that aren't, you know,
just from
the middle class, the working class. Yeah.
Right. No, absolutely. No, yeah, I think, no, thank you for that. Thank you for those observations. No, it's, interesting to see how this is going to develop. And also, it's important to note that, this is not even the big kahuna yet of the strike.
No, we're still ramping up, yeah.
Yeah, because usually, like, the unlimited strike, where they're just striking for an unlimited amount of days until they get negotiation demands met, that has not even happened yet. So these are all kind of, like, warning strikes that they would do before leading up to that. And it seems like there is still strong support. It seems like morale is still high. So I personally am expecting it to go into unlimited strikes into the holiday season. And, should be interesting. If you see them out there, go bring them some coffee, start honking, give them a little woo. Yeah. Shout out to people striking right now.
Solidarity for
up next, let's talk about a party that people call the Montreal Party in provincial politics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Québec Solidaire. They have just recently elected a new co-spokesperson. So Québec Solidaire, unlike other parties, does not have a leader in the strictest sense.
Yeah.
They have two people who represent the wishes of the membership of the steering committees and so on. These
collective
people
are, leadership. Yeah.
Exactly, collective leadership. They have a rule about gender parity among the co-spokespeople. Mm-hmm. Currently, we have Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, who is the co-spokesperson. He represents the riding of Gouin out in the Rosemont area, eastern Montreal. And the former co-spokesperson, Manon Massé, she's now out. It was her last kind of a term as a co-spokesperson.
Still an M&A representing
Saint-Marie.
Saint-Jacques,
yeah, exactly. And now she's been replaced. There's elections held at the party congress in Gatineau this last week. It was a tight race between Rouba Ghazal, a Palestinian M&A who represents sort of the plateau area, and the winner, Émilie Lessard-Terrien, out in... she's a former M&A from Abitibi-Témiscamingue, a sort of a mining community, rural, regional, right next to the border of Ontario, kind of not too far from Timmins, I think Val-d'Or is a part of it, but like sort of in that kind of like northern region. And curious as to your thoughts about this new co-spokesperson.
I have so many thoughts. But
that's
but,
good for the show.
I will try to parse them properly. So Quebec Solidaire, I think, is primary preoccupation right now is where they're going to expand their reach. Because they had a sort of precipitous rise. They started with two, I think they went up to, anyway, I don't remember, but they added. In every election, they kept adding.
Yeah, it went from 2 to 3 to 9. And then now I believe they're at 12.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, what they say is they've hit the plafond, they've hit the ceiling. Mm-hmm. In the last election specifically, I think they lost the seat, they gained a few others. They've taken a strategy of basically going hard on this, emphasizing sovereignty. And they've really tried to like lock down the sovereigntist vote. And that's, it seems has significantly backfired. It did seem like a brilliant move, in the 2018 election when they made those big gains outside of Montreal. They also won in Abitibi-Témiscamingue, which was Émilie's Lessard-Terrien. So they were able to get off the island of Montreal by mobilizing a, you know, activist base of, people like the Option Nationale people. They basically merged with Option Nationale and became, and got a bunch of new young sovereigntist activists. And they benefited from that. But now they're sort of, hitting the ceiling, and they're trying to figure out where their support's going to come from. They lost it. I think Emily's lost her seat in the last
2021,
election.
Yeah.
So you had a sort of, kind of clear which direction should we go leadership contest. And the two leading candidates were Rouba Ghazal and Émilie's. And it's interesting because I think they all have worked closely together. They all like each other. And oddly, there's not a lot of the debates are available online. You actually had to go look at like somebody had like propped up their phone at a weird angle, and like you can hardly even make out the faces of the people. That's how you have to watch the debate on YouTube. I watched it nonetheless. And it was interesting because it's like, it's a bit of a love fest, honestly. Like the three candidates. The other one was, you have to remind me of her last name, Christine
Labrie from Sherbrooke.
So the three of them, I think Christine Labrie is clearly sort of aiming for the future, in the sense of
getting her name out there.
Yeah, probably not, certainly not as polished as the other two. Like it was pretty clear that the Émilie Lessard-Terrien and Rouba Ghazal were the front runners. They're both very well spoken, very very dynamic, very engaging personalities. You know, certainly the level of political talent that some other parties won't get into could feel very jealous of. I think to have that much political talent on the stage, just in terms of how you present and how you get your ideas across. Mm-hmm. Rouba's pitch was very much, I'm going to go to the banlieue. I'm going to go get new. I'm going to connect to people in the suburbs.
Right. She grew up in Laval.
Because I'm a child of the suburbs, she says. And it was also like a pretty heavy emphasis on like the sort of isms, the sovereignism, feminism, and a few other things. Very, very, very clear set of ideas, just in terms of the orientation of the party. You didn't have a lot of policy debate, which is interesting. I think also a function of their sort of leadership structure, because the policy doesn't really get made by the leaders as much. Mm-hmm. It gets made more by the membership. And then Emilie's La Sauterien was really going hard on Les Régions. You know, she's I think she had a great line from the leadership convention, where she said, I wanna be from the regions like like the cowboy flanga. Play the Bell Center, but not forget
to tour the
little villages. So that's, you know, I thought that was a really, like, really encapsulated sort of what she's talking about. And it's interesting because it was definitely like a clear, in terms of like who you're going to appeal to, it was a clear sort of fork in the road. Mm-hmm. In terms of like, you know, clearly, Ruba Ghazal was going to be able to appeal more to sort of, racialized immigrants, people who are sort of outsiders, and bring them into the sort of their sovereignist project and sort of create an example of how that can happen on an individual level. Mm-hmm. And of course, Emilie's is there, you know, driving her Ford F-150, food sovereignty activist, talking about,
she's a farmer.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Talking about getting people in the regions, in Les Régions, as they say, to understand why Quebec Solidaire is the better choice for them. And so the membership, by 3 delegate votes, chose Emilie's La Sauterien. And so I think, you know, of course, since then it's sort of resurfaced. She had made news several years ago by complaining about the sort of accaparement de terre, the land grabs that were happening. Mm-hmm. And she was specifically sort of citing like Chinese predators that were coming in and buying up all the land
I think her quote is like, where I'm from, we call them predators.
Yeah, exactly. Entre nous, so right. amongst ourselves, that gives it the sort of conspiratorial vibe. I think she's since sort of recanted, certainly apologized, and I think, you know, has tried to put the emphasis back on the sort of collect. I don't think she quite gets it, honestly. But she has put the emphasis back on more on the sort of collective structures as opposed to, you know, individuals. But this caused quite a stir at the time. Like there were, you know, some 300 people from the Chinese community in Montreal actually marched on Quebec Solidaire's offices, to denounce this, shall we say, very unfortunate turn of phrase, that obviously plays into a whole history of racism against
xenophobia in Canada.
Yeah. Right. And also plays into the xenophobia among the elite.
Of course.
So you have the sort of history of sort of racism at the working class level, but then you also have the current like sort of xenophobia among our ruling class, where they're freaking out about, you know, China and all these different ways. They're throwing these absolute fit about the Michaels and all this stuff. There's all these ways in which it sort of taps into the worst
of course, yeah,
of Canadian society. So I just thought it was interesting, sort of indicative. I mean, I think that she's probably learned something from that. Mm-hmm. Maybe not enough to be fully attuned, but I think it comes back to like the basic demographic realities of Quebec. Like in the rest of Canada, you have 25% or more, you know, people who are sort of what they call visible minorities, like racialized people, making up the population and throwing their weight around, increasingly politically, mm-hmm. making their presence felt. Whereas in Quebec, I think it's like under 10%. Mm-hmm. And so it's just not as much, it just doesn't factor in the sort of pressure isn't there to make the political class in general, which isn't to excuse any individual, but I think that's why you have this. I think Quebec Solidaire does make a lot of effort to try to like sensibilize, I guess, or educate their membership and create these sort of discussions and dialogues and so on. But it just hasn't, the basic political culture hasn't sort of gotten there.
To that point.
To the point of, to the point of just respecting people and understanding where they're coming from and understanding the history and how they might, and how a phrase like that might, you know, not just offend, but hurt people,
Of course.
So, which isn't to like, it's, I don't think it's a knock on Emily's, I think she's just reflecting her milieu, you know, she's reflecting where she's coming from, but yeah, it'll be really interesting because now you have, Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, like, you know, noted nationalist, but who is trying to sort of fit multiculturalism under nationalism, which is an interesting challenge. And I think Emily's has the same, basically the same approach from what I can tell, to sort of how to deal with, you know, people from multiple backgrounds.
Like a sort of a pluralistic nationalism.
Pluralistic nationalism, yeah, based on the actual lived experience. But the lived experience, of course, is very segregated.
Of course.
So that is, there's the like fundamental contradiction of what, of the sort of cultural and political project that they're trying to take on. And it's going to be interesting. And it'll be really interesting to see. I mean, she's a very, very clearly very talented politician. Doesn't currently have a seat in the National Assembly, and so is going to be hitting the ground, you know, probably talking to a lot of riding associations and members, and has made it clear that she's really interested in bringing these sort of deeper transformative projects, whether it's food sovereignty or climate change or the Constituent Assembly, which is their sort of method for achieving sovereignty, their proposed method. So yeah, she's really interested in selling those more, those deeper projects, which it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
I think to cap off what you're saying, I think in 2018, I thought Emily's was the kind of most significant kind of development for QS, right?
Absolutely.
Because in 2018, QS was able to, I think, triple their seat count. They were able to get off the island. But even though they got off the island, they got to like, I think two seats in Quebec, one in Sherbrooke, which are still kind of these urban centers, right? But
Here
you had MLEs in like, in Abitibi, right? And I think they were able to mobilize the people at the CEGEP there. But now you have this kind of like, a sort of a beachhead into the regions, right? Which is something that I find like, is kind of an issue for a lot of parties, especially kind of like left parties, right? They're kind of considered this kind of like the urbanites, the liberal urbanites that like, or maybe just kind of like, those people who are whether educated to a certain extent, where the Liberal Party is no longer in interest, and so now it's like the left parties. But it's going to be absolutely interesting seeing what the direction of the party is going to be like for the next 4 years. And it's also like it does kind of put a bit of a less of a Montreal focus on it, right? So it kind of shows while Montreal during like all the kind of progressive movements here that formed QS early on, that was the kind of the coalition between them, between the anti-racist, feminist movements, nationalist movements that sort of coalesced into QS, and then how they picked up people, a lot of people, right, from the student strikes in Montreal. And now it shows this kind of direction where, like, okay, like, while we were kind of like, this, like, Montreal was like the kind of nursery for us, there was this kind of like, specifically, I would say, like a vision, a cosmopolitan vision of nationalism, right, that was born here through those coalitions, and that is now starting to kind of like, blossom and expand and explore into the regions, and it's going to be interesting seeing what the pitch is, how people receive it, because the regions are incredibly, incredibly leaning in the favor of either. Well, it used to be the CAC, but now you have the PQ sort of on the rise again, which is interesting to see. We have to wrap things up quickly.
Sure.
You, this was a last minute addition. I thought it was kind of funny. If we could, yeah. So here we have the War on Christmas. In back.
I just want to salute Justin Trudeau's troops and their valiant efforts in taking the war to Christmas.
Yes, finally.
Christmas will be defeated in our lifetimes.
All right, so here we have an article in the National Post. Federal Commission declares Christmas holiday is religious intolerance. Yeah. The Canadian Human Rights Commission, which wields broad quasi-judicial powers, argued that a day off on Christmas is discriminatory. And this is by Tristan Hopper in the National Post. You hate Christmas, Drew?
No, but I absolutely believe that Christmas should be defeated in the war on Christmas.
In the war on Christmas,
Justin Trudeau is absolutely bold. in his progressive moves to eliminate Christmas. I think that's amazing.
What do you think is going on here? Why do you think this?
So if we actually looked into it,
I mean, seriously now.
It's extremely silly, but it has become sort of national news. So that's what makes it interesting. Is it's like, okay, basically you have a couple of like, you know, medium to small size right wing Twitter accounts that a week and a bit ago discovered somebody either fed it to them or they discovered it somehow or somebody mentioned it and they tweeted about it. But anyway, they discovered this statement on the Canadian Human Rights Commission's website that says, you know, people basically states the obvious. So like people get time off for Christmas, but people from other religions have to ask for that time off, you know, for their...
It's not automatic.
For their holy days,
right,
yeah.
Right. They have to put more effort.
Exactly. And, you know, it's not always possible and so on. People schedule things and there's no recognition. So they basically say that and then they say... there's actually been quite a history of imposing Christianity on people. Also, not particularly controversial. I mean, nobody's denying that, yeah, Christianity has been forced on people to a very significant degree, and this is part of a bigger colonial project. And the statement basically says that. And I think there's maybe like one bridging sentence that sort of puts those two things together. So the implication, I didn't read it as thoroughly enough, but there's no immediate policy conclusion like, oh, we should get rid of Christmas.
Right.
But anyway, these right-wing Twitter accounts
need to kill Santa Claus.
dug out this sentence, quoted it on Twitter. Two or three days later, it shows up in a National Post column. Our illustrious hedge fund, U.S. New Jersey hedge fund owned press network, pays people a lot of money. You could trace Tristan Hopper a nice salary to dig these things up on Twitter and make them into a national news. Mm-hmm. So that's where you get this. And then you have the Legault government.
Not just that, but it was pretty unanimous in the National Assembly.
Yeah. Sure.
In support of Legault's decision.
Yeah. So Legault comes and says, oh, well, we are going to fight back in the war on Christmas. And this is perfect because, you know, as we just said, like 7 out of 10 people are, 7 out of 10 people are supporting not his side. Like it's like 20% who back him in his like attempt to like break, you know, make public sector workers like take a pay cut. And so what better kind of distraction from that than to fight back valiantly in the war on Christmas? Yeah. And, you know, why wouldn't he take that served up on a platter by the National Post? So now, yeah, there's a whole news cycle about Quebec's brave
support of Christmas.
Brave support of Christmas.
Right. It's great. I love that from a government that says they're like, you know, trying to separate church and state, and here they are, be like, no, we need this.
But I also love that it sort of, you know, again, it's like, you know, religious minorities are probably like a much smaller proportion overall of Quebec's. So we're getting into it sort of ties together two topics here. We just talked about Legault's sort of waning popularity and the sort of dynamism of Quebec political culture in the sense that they've just yanked the rug out from under him in terms of support. But then you also have, you know, QS, which is reflecting, I think, just the obviousness that Christmas is something that everybody celebrates. Mm-hmm. I don't know how QS voted, but I think Emily's Le Sartanian's like comments about, you know, Chinese predators are in that same vein of this is sort of ignorance, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you live in Montreal, you probably have friends who don't celebrate Christmas or eat Chinese food or do whatever they do instead. There you go.
That's two for two.
I was actually going to ask you, what's your experience of this, of Christmas? Because, Yeah, I mean, I think if you live in a multicultural society, which most Quebecers do not, you know, it's obvious that Christmas is this kind of weird, like, okay, it's a stat holiday, but it's also a commercial holiday, but right. It's also this, you know, baby Jesus, and everyone else is, and everyone who's not steeped in that is kind of like, okay, you know, I don't know. You tell me, how do you relate to Christmas?
So listen, growing up, we celebrated Christmas, but it was just kind of like, it's a day off, you know, it's a day off. We're going to have like, it's just an opportunity to have dinner with family, share, exchange presents and stuff like that. That's really the extent of it, you know. Yeah. I think I still am kind of a believer in whatever kind of like holiday spirit in this time of like whatever, like sharing and like feasting, right? But like really on that kind of like on the broadest level of that, you know, like if it wasn't Christmas and they called it something else, but it was still effectively we're sharing gifts and we're gonna like eating together, to me that's what's the important part, much less the actual like where like baby Jesus part and stuff like that. Like I remember specifically with like Santa, I mean, we lived in like an apartment, right? We didn't have a fireplace, and I was asking my mom when I was young, I was like, how does he get here? And my mom was like, he actually phases through the wall. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah. So, I mean, I guess...
So much for the chimney.
Yeah. So there's always, like, parts of Christmas that didn't quite fit well into my life. But in the war on Christmas, I am joining the side of Christmas. I am a believer of, maybe not the Legault's vision of it, but I do believe in the kind of, like, the spirit of the holidays.
As the holiday season approaches, we'll have to have some more in-depth debates.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pro and con Christmas.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be it for this episode, Drew. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you everyone for listening, for sticking through. Thank you to the crew as well. If you want to listen to more Metropolis, you can click those links in the bio. Thank you very much, and see you next time.